Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Here's a variation on a podcast. It's time for Must Have Seen TV, the podcast dedicated to the sitcoms of the 20th century. From I Love Lucy to News Radio, I'm your TV guy, Brett White, and I'm also a reporter, producer for Decider.com, and this week I am joined by actor, comedian, you can see him on The Chris Gethard Show on True TV, Mr. Connor Ratliff. Hello, Connor.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming out here and exposing me to something totally wildly new and different.
Yes, yes. A historic sitcom.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm excited to get into it.
Yeah.
And also, you're a fellow Queenshead like myself.
Yes.
I'm trying to figure out if you had the shortest commute out to my place.
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah, maybe.
It was like a 15-minute bus ride.
Did anyone get into a fight on the bus?
No. It was very calm and quiet because it was a little bit, it was past the rush hour.
Okay.
The people were, you could tell people were not in, no one was in a good mood on the bus.
Of course.
But, But there were no incidents.
I find that every time I get on the Queen's bus, there is a fight of some sort. There is an argument. There's someone screaming about killing someone.
No, it was quiet. It was like 7:30 in the evening, so it was, you know, relatively past the rush, past all the
New York transit. I find riding the bus is like taking a trip back to like 70s New York for me.
Yeah.
It's the great equalizer and also nightmare. But this week we are actually traveling to March 31st, 1988. Biloxi Blues ruled the box office. Ooh. Man of the Mirror by Michael Jackson topped the charts, and NBC aired the Days and Nights of Molly Dodd episode, Here Are a Few Variations on a Sexual Theme. Connor, you must have seen Here Are a Few Variations on a Sexual Theme before.
Yeah, I would have watched this as it aired.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because it was part of the, it was a summer replacement series. And I believe that was a Thursday night. It was
a Thursday night show.
And it was
I have the lineup right here.
Yeah, it was packed with hits. Thursday night, this was
Cosby Show, A Different World, Cheers, Days and Nights of Molly Dodd, L.A. Law.
L.A. Law. So it this was like sandwiched in between nothing but hits.
Yeah.
And
also shows that are totally different.
Yes.
Totally different.
And Days and Nights of Molly Dodd was, they didn't know what to call it. They called it a dramedy. The word dramedy was invented, I believe, for this show.
So this is Patient Zero.
Yeah, I mean, I believe there were some shows prior to this that didn't have, that were single camera, but when you look on IMDb, this says this was the first show that was conceived.
Okay, yeah.
With that, where the plan was, there'll be no studio audience, there'll be no laugh track.
Yeah.
It will be shot. I mean, now it's the norm.
Which I have issues about that I've gotten into in link. Listen to the Frasier episode with Winston Knoll where we just rail about it for way too long.
Yeah.
The thing was like most of the 60s sitcoms were single cam shot without an audience, but it's like Mr. Ed and the Addams Family and Bewitched, and it's like they
so they're like studio, but they're on a set though.
They
a
were
lot
on
of
a
times.
Set, and
yeah.
and they would throw in fake laughter, but it's like those shows involved a lot of weird special effects, like making a horse talk.
Yeah.
So they didn't want to make an audience sit through that, most likely.
Yeah.
And so that's why in the 70s and 80s there was this really big push of Cheers was filmed in front of a live studio audience.
Yeah.
Or all the MTM shows at the end would say Mary Tyler Moore was shot in front of a live audience.
I actually think it was a big mistake for them to stop saying that at the beginning of of multi-camera.
Because people go back and like, it's all fake. It's like, none of it is actually fake.
Yeah.
Even How I Met Your Mother, which I'd learned, they shot it all on a multi-cam soundstage, but with no audience, and they shot it more single-cam style, because there's a lot of flashback and editing and stuff.
Yeah.
But then they would play the edited episodes for an audience and record that laughter.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it still is a weird hybrid, but still the laughter is real.
It bugs me when people call things laugh tracks that are just studio audience laughter.
Yeah. Legit
that's
laughter.
That's not a laugh track.
Yeah.
That is an audience.
Is a track of actual real laughter and not a weird, like, not on GarageBand right now. I could open up a laugh track and play it right now over under us.
But I think they blew it when they stopped saying it, because I still remember that. It's a sentence that always struck me as a kid when I said, cheers, this film for a live studio audience. Oh,
John Ratzenberger saying it, too. And so that's why this, I guess in terms of the lineup, this does seem like a nice bridge between Cheers and L.A. Law.
Yeah.
There's a kind of, it's like it's getting you ready for the drama.
Cheers being maybe the, in my opinion, the multi-camera set sitcom that looks and feels the least like it's on a set.
Yeah. Just so weird. Because it is, like, the most setty set, because it is literally, like, one giant room, but it feels
it
so lived.
It looks so good, and they just figured out their angles so well.
Yeah.
Like, I never imagined where the, like, I think it would really blow my mind if anyone ever showed me a shot of the camera pulling out.
Yeah.
I would just be like, I can picture it on Seinfeld, I can picture exactly why, Jerry's apartment's like this, because the cameras are right there. On Cheers, I'm like, that's a bar.
Yeah, I have no idea. How familiar are you with the Home Improvement house?
Not at all.
Okay, because the episode I did with Jeremy Benn about that, I realized that it's actually really intricate. Like, I think that it was built on an angle because the camera can get all the way to the front door, but then all the way to the front to where the couch is.
Yeah.
And so I think the audience is sitting, like, at a weird angle to where they can just see this bisected half of an entire long, because usually it's, you know, four walls and just one of the walls is removed.
Yeah.
But this is more like a quarter of the house is removed, so you can see the kitchen and it's really ridiculous.
Yeah.
There's some real artistry to these multicam sets that has been lost. People don't appreciate it. I, of course, I did not watch this show. I think that you talking about this on another podcast probably informed me of its existence. Did you bring it up on any...
I've talked about it on any podcast where it's been appropriate.
Episodes.
Oh, yeah. Any chance to bring this show up, because it had an effect on me. I remember I'd never seen anything like it. I remember thinking it was funny, but it wasn't afraid to not be funny.
Exactly, yeah.
Which is true of a lot of great... Like, Cheers was like that, too. Cheers wasn't afraid to not be funny.
Golden Girls has an AIDS episode. Like.
Yeah. And that they were and the best sitcoms certainly MASH, you know, any great sitcom it usually has the courage to go like, oh, this scene doesn't need a lot of jokes because they wouldn't fit, you know. And so but I also remember just being I only recently found out that the first two seasons because the first two seasons, it was a summer replacement series, very well reviewed.
Only 13 episodes each season.
Yeah.
Which is also unusual for the time.
Yeah. Closer to like a British model in some ways of like a short order. Now it's a common, it's
yeah, 13's
more
like,
common.
Oh, okay, yeah, 13, yeah.
Because I think creators like it better. Back then it was almost like hedging your bets a little bit. It was kind of like, well, we'll order a half a season basically.
Because normally like it would have gotten a 13 episode first season, then a 22 to 24 second season, but not the case.
And it also it broke so many it did so many things that never happened before because it was also a show that got canceled after its second season on NBC and then got picked up by Lifetime, the cable network, and it ran for three more seasons and still like Blair Brown, the star who plays Molly Dodd, she was nominated for Best Actress Emmy for all five seasons,
which is also because I remember growing up in the mid to late 90s, I would love cable shows, but it's like, well, they'll never get nominated for an Emmy because Emmys are for... Because at the time, I was convinced Emmys were for network shows.
And
Cable Ace Awards.
it also did very well with the Cable Ace Awards because it was like, of all the sparse field of cable TV shows, it was a show that had like, you survived. You came from prestigious network.
Yeah, you clawed your way back.
And you found your way back. But it was nominated for both Best Drama Awards at Cable Ace and Best Comedy Awards.
Like the same year even?
I don't know if it was the same year. It may have been one year or the other, but I know it was nominated in both. So people just didn't know what to think about it.
Nowadays, it's unequivocally a comedy, because comedy, I mean, like, that's another thing of, like...
It's 30 minutes.
It's 30 minutes, so therefore it's a comedy. Yeah. There is, like, if there's, like, a light joke in it, it's a comedy, which always makes me really annoyed. It's like, Transparent, great show, not great jokes. Like, it's not a hilarious
right,
show.
Right, it veers more toward the dramatic, yeah. So there were so many things about it at the time that were... They were just different to me. And also, but I only just recently found out that the first two seasons, including, like, the episode that we watched, the show was based in L.A.
Oh, really?
And you would not get that feeling because they do so many exterior shots that are in New York.
Well, also, those are very New York-y actors.
The whole cast, everybody making the show were New York people.
Yeah.
So they had to go to L.A. So when Lifetime picked it up, they moved the production to New York.
Man.
And but it feels like a New York show. It doesn't feel like one of those New York shows that's kind of, you know, people in LA doing a show based on their memory of New York.
Right.
It feels like a very specific it has a lived in sort of feeling. Yeah. In its relationship to New York.
That's so wild. And you watched it as it aired.
Yeah.
Wow, that's... how old were you when it started? Like,
I guess what year did it start? It started in 87.
This is 88,
well,
so I guess it
started
87.
In 87, so I would have been 12 years old.
Were people, were your peers into this? Like, were you the
no,
outlier?
I didn't know anybody who watched this show.
Even adults? Did you know any adults that were
I mean,
it?
I was 12. Who would I have talked to about this? I don't think I had ever had conversations with with anybody about this show. I just knew I liked it. I knew that I probably had a bigger crush on Blair Brown because it was also her performance is so great on the show.
Yeah.
And she's, you know, it's a show. There's a danger in, you know, you make a show and it's about you know, there's that danger of like a show like Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip where the central problem that they set up for themselves is they make a show about this comedy show is so great that everybody loves it. And it's like, well, show us the comedy show. And then when you see it, you're like...
Oh, my God.
And so there's a danger in creating a show about a character that people are charmed by, because if you're not charmed by that person, then the premise of the show kind of crumbles.
Wait, so that's the premise?
I mean, to a certain extent, it's not like it's not specifically that that's the premise. It's, you know, her life and her struggles and stuff like that. But she is a character that is meant to be charming.
Right.
And so it's easy to imagine someone less charming tanking the show.
Because I got that. That totally came across. Wait, what did she do before and after this?
After this, I mean, more people are probably familiar with her from Orange is the New Black. She plays Judy King on that show. She was Nina Sharp on Fringe.
Okay.
She's consistently just worked and worked and worked.
Yeah.
I think prior to this, like, one of her big things, I think she was in the movie Altered States.
Okay.
She was in a movie with John Belushi that Steven Spielberg executive produced called Continental Divide, which I still haven't seen, even though everything about that sounds like I should have seen it. Like, it sounds...
That's like when I discovered the movie First Family.
Yeah.
Have you heard of that? Which is, it's written by Buck Henry. Uh-huh. It stars Bob Newhart as the president.
Okay.
Madeline Kahn as the first lady.
All right, no reason not to see
and
this
And Gilda
movie.
Radner as their daughter.
Yeah.
And it's awful, but, like, I rented it on iTunes because, like, I have to do this. It has Bob Newhart in a George Washington costume in it, like...
Yeah, you gotta see what that's like.
But it's like, how did I not know that? Not so that cast is killer, but it's just, like... It's a movie from 1980, a male-dominated era, and Madeline Kahn and Gilda Radner do nothing! And it's like, no!
Yeah,
so it's frustrating.
I once saw Blair Brown and Victor Garber in a production of Arcadia.
Wait, like, concurrent with this? Or
no,
like
no,
later?
It was like a decade or so later.
And I bet they're still friends.
Oh, I hope so. I'd be devastated if they weren't.
I think that Victor Garber is... I mean, we'll get in...
We'll get into
we'll,
that.
We'll get...
Basically, in the first season, a lot of it is about, you know, Molly Dodd's a single woman in New York City. It's sort of like, I was never a fan of Sex and the City, and I always, in my mind, I always thought back to, like, I already have my show that's, like, a New York City, single woman in New York City.
Was Ally McBeal? That was Boston.
Yeah.
Was Boston? Yeah.
But it definitely is, like, this is one of the ancestors of that show.
Right. Yeah, it gets that total vibe, except I might like this more. I don't know.
Yeah. But it's... In the first season, a lot of it has to do with, you know, Molly is divorced. She is struggling to find what her career is, what her personal life is. She's sort of, she's in New York City, and it's kind of like, where is her life going to go? Like,
yeah.
What is, she's like looking for where, then she's like mid-30s, trying to figure it out. And it already sort of feels like the life she had already has sort of like fallen apart. And in the first episode, she finds out that the guy she's been seeing, Dennis Widmer, was her boss.
Okay.
She started seeing him and then found out that he was married and then found out that he also had basically had affairs with all the other women in this office. And Victor Garber's character, and this was the first time I ever, that the reason I know who Victor Garber is,
oh, wow,
is because of this show. Like, I was like, that guy's funny. He plays a character that, in my way, when I, the way I picture this character, it's such a great, I picture it as like the prototype for a certain kind of character that like Job on Arrested Development.
Right, yeah,
it's
yeah,
that
yeah,
sort of like, charismatic, awful person.
Yeah.
You know, that it's like, has all these very low tendencies. You know, a liar, a sleaze, but something so transparently desperate that it's charming.
Yeah.
Even while he is like a scumbag, you know? A similar feeling that I get from like Jeffrey Tambor on a Larry Sanders Show.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The characters I'm drawn to, in the first season or two of Newhart, the character of Kirk.
Oh God, yeah.
Who I think is this underrated, like, just like, what a sleaze.
Yeah.
But like such a great comic performance. And Victor Garber falls right into that tradition,
yeah,
with this character.
See that.
Where he's like, Molly, I need you. But then the next sentence will be something terrible.
Yeah.
Something like, oh my God, is that my wife? Where he's such a coward and such a, but he's so driven.
Yeah.
And so you meet him right away in the first episode, but then he just recurs throughout the course of the show. I had always assumed that the reason that the supporting cast is so great and the guest appearances are so great was because it's a New York show. I was
right,
like, oh, they're drawing all these theater actors. But now that's sort of blown up in my head because they were flying these actors from New York to LA to film in these first two seasons. But that was their approach. It was like, you see these actors that you associate with, like, oh, these guys were all doing plays. These
yeah,
actors and actresses were all doing New York theater at the time. And so it has a different feel. You don't see, it's a different crew of faces than if you watch the LA regular sitcoms of the time.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like a whole bunch of, like, desperate actors are just like, here's my headshot, like, I'm going out for a thing. Like,
yeah.
Let's transition into the episode itself.
Yes.
So yeah, this week on Must Have Seen TV, we're talking about the Days and Nights of Molly Dodd episode. Here are a few variations on a sexual theme. It is the second episode of season 2. It was written by Jay Tarsis and Bob Brush and directed by Jay Tarsis. And here is how, like, the internet describes the episode. Molly's psychiatrist tells her why she no longer wants Molly as a patient. Connor, how accurate is that description?
It is accurate, but it is also, it would be like saying that Star Wars is about two robots who fly off of a ship.
Yeah.
Where it's like, that happened, but yeah, it's one of, like,
oh my,
a dozen things that happened.
I wanted to point out, since I brought up his name, that this was created by Jay Tarsis.
Yes.
Who was co-showrunner of the, like, back half of the Bob Newhart show.
Uh-huh.
And his, so we talked about this before watching it, of, like, Tom Patchett and Jay Tarsis were a writing team in the 70s and, like, early to mid-80s.
Yeah.
And they ran Bob Newhart together, and they, I read interviews with them from that time about how they loved emphasizing weird and dry humor, and, like, they liked experimenting.
Mm-hmm.
So then you get to the late 80s, literally
yeah,
this, like, week of television, and they split apart, and Tom Patchett is off doing Alf, and Jay Tarsis is doing this. And after watching it, I can totally see how both of them together equals the back half of Bob Newhart show.
Yes.
Because Tom Patchett, who's doing Elf, is, like, loves, like, zingers, broad humor. He loves having a puppet on. I mean, even, like, the concept of Elf is a pretty high concept weird
yeah,
thing. It's like, yeah, I could see where Bob Newhart show would do that. But then you have this, which is a lot drier, also weird, but in a drier way.
In a it all can happen. Like,
yeah,
there are elements in this episode doesn't have it. There are episodes where it veers into the kind of sort of, like, fantasy
okay,
that is, would later, like, Ally McBeal would do that. You know, there are, like, flights of fancy.
Yeah.
There are elements that pop into the show, and I think maybe more of that in the Lifetime seasons even. So where it gets whimsical.
It's just Jay fascinating.
Jay Tarsus also co-wrote The Great Muppet Caper and Muppets Take Manhattan.
Ugh.
And I think...
Wait, who did you write him with?
I assume...
Was it with Tom Hatcher, or...
No, let me look and see.
Man, that's the thing. I don't like writing teams. Is it like cheating on your writing part?
Yeah,
like,
he wrote it with Tom Patchett, Jerry Jewell, Jack Rose wrote Great Muppet Caper. And let me see who Muppets Take Manhattan. Yeah, Tom Patchett and Jay Tarsus wrote the story, and Frank Oz wrote the screenplay with them.
And then what happened to break them up?
I mean... Like, this is a story I don't know.
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah. I mean, speculate.
At a certain point, it's like, Tarsus ditched the puppets, and Patchett was just like, I want to keep doing puppet stuff.
Oh, man, wait, maybe the Muppet stuff was like the flashpoint for them or whatever. It's like, Patchett's like, pick down my calling. I'm puppets.
Yeah, he's like, no, I want to do just humans in New York City. Yeah. That's what I liked about Muppets Take Manhattan, is the humans.
Oh, yeah, wow, so this is also a split of Muppets.
Muppets Take Manhattan, they each took a different path. That, you know what was fun working on that is... filming in New York, and...
No, it was fun. It was the heightened sets and a lot of long hours.
They also... he also did the show Buffalo Bill.
Right,
which... The Dabney Coleman one, which I've never seen that show. I saw the Slap Maxwell story, which was a few years later Dabney Coleman, single camera kind of dramedy. But Buffalo Bill is always a show that's mentioned as...
Right, yeah. I've had that mentioned to me by Alejandro Abona, who did one of the News Radio episodes. It was like, I want to do that next time. So now...
Like, innovative, paving the way for what is going to come with, like, Larry Sanders and then other...
It's really fascinating to see... That's the thing I like about this podcast, is actually getting to track these, like, weird career trajectories.
Yeah.
Of these people behind the scenes that we never... Like, people listening to this podcast probably have never heard the names... Tom Patchett and Jay Tarsus,
right,
as much as they have
in the last 48 seconds, yeah.
Alone. So yeah, this episode, like that. So like, start with that.
Yeah.
With that synopsis, that is one
it's
of
one scene.
There's like
and a prelude to it.
There's about like six different almost vignettes.
Yeah.
In this, like, there's not an A, B, C plot.
Yeah, and that was I think that was an innovation for any sitcom.
Yeah.
I don't think prior to Days of My Dad that sitcoms did that. Sort of in the same way that, like, I mean, maybe they did it on something like Married Hartman, where it was, like, a serialized soap opera or, like, things like that. But generally speaking, like, it was not a common trend for a sitcom to have so many plots that were none of them are resolved necessarily in a single episode. Because the Dr. Litchfield plot.
Yeah.
The
psychiatrist plot.
That was set up in the previous episode, and I think maybe something even possibly in the first season, that she had this therapist who was like, take phone calls during the therapy session, kind of seemed like maybe a bad therapist.
Oh, so this is really serialized storytelling in the era way before that.
Yeah. And then in season two, Molly Dodd is like, sees her on the street, and she's ignored by her. And I think that had happened in the previous episode as well.
Yeah.
So it was like a runner that was like, my therapist, I can't get a hold of her, and she won't talk to me. And I actually, it occurred to me because who's the creator of Orange is the New Black? I'm blanking.
Ginger Cohen,
yeah. I believe this was a show, as indicated by her casting Blair Brown.
Right.
A big part of Orange is the New Black. I would almost guarantee that this show was a show that she loved and that this was an influence.
Oh, yeah, I can see that.
Dr. Litchfield.
Right.
Litchfield. Women's Penitentiary. Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty... I was thinking...
I think it might be... It's either a subconscious callback or it's a deliberate...
Yeah.
I'm going to name this prison after this name.
And I would guess that is a question that she's never been asked in an interview either.
Yeah, did you name this after the three-episode character in Days of Night Small Dodd?
So, like, just to go through the different things, like, because I just want to, like, run through, like, this outline of this episode just to give listeners an idea of how kind of...
Especially since listeners...
You've not seen this.
And if you want to see this, good luck. I'll give you a tip. There is a website. The reason I have this is because I purchased bootleg DVDs of the Days of My Dad off of a website that I'm going to mention it, even though I'm always nervous that this website will vanish.
Yeah.
There's a website. Have you ever heard of a website called sell.com?
S-E-L-L.com. No.
It's been around for a long time, because I bought these discs a long time ago. And I don't know why it hasn't been shut down, because it's it's not the dark web or whatever that is. But you will find so many people selling old TV shows, sometimes kind of pricily, on DVD-Rs. And I think I probably bought these for like $50 or something.
Is this a cover art?
No, just like an envelope full of discs. Numbered. like if I lose...
Handed it to you by a guy in a trench coat.
Yeah, the numbers are on the little paper envelope, so I gotta make sure I don't get them mixed up, because otherwise I'll be like, I'm lost. But, so like, finding this show, other than this website, which even mentioning it, I worry, am I gonna lead to...
Or you're gonna get on a list or something?
Or that, just like some, like, district attorney is gonna listen to your podcast and be like, oh, we should shut that down.
Yeah, we should go after this guy.
Don't shut it down, it's benign.
Also, especially if you have... This is also the Bob Crane Show from this. I'm looking at my computer as if I'm looking at the listeners.
Yeah.
The Bob Crane Show from the 70s.
Yeah.
Which, have you ever heard of that?
No.
After Hogan's Heroes, Bob Crane, like, MTM was, like, turning out, like, Mary Tyler Moore, Bob Newhart. They had, like, the formula down of, we're going to take a person, put them in, like, a unique profession, unique city. So they grabbed Bob Crane and dropped him in his own show, where he was like a general practitioner doctor kind of guy.
Yeah.
It only lasted under one season, because it was underwatched. But the reason I need to see it is because John Astin is in an episode, and John Astin plays a gay man in it. And Bob Cratcher has a That Gay episode with John Astin. If you listen to my Addams Family episode, you'd know my thoughts about John Astin.
Do you know how to find this show?
No, it doesn't exist anywhere.
Trycell.com.
Yeah,
do a search for it. I haven't been able to find everything that I've been looking for, but I found things that I haven't found anywhere else. I got Fernwood Tonight. I bought those on bootleg DVDs from there.
Because, is Patty Deutsch on that? No, it's Joyce Boulafont.
I still haven't had time to watch
that. There's a lot of Match Game people. I think Fanny Flagg might be on some. There's a lot of Match Game people that are on that show, too.
The thing I keep not pulling the trigger on, because it's $75 for two seasons to buy it on there, is I'll Fly Away, which was the drama that David Chase was EP on prior to The Sopranos. It was created by Joshua Brand and John Falzi, who did Saint Elsewhere and Northern Exposure.
Wait, what years was that?
This was early 90s. It was Sam Waterston, and it was basically like a TV show version of To Kill a Mockingbird, but it was darker than To Kill a Mockingbird. Like, it was more complicated.
On the network?
On NBC.
Wow.
Friday nights on NBC.
Yeah, it's a pretty dark time.
But
adults are home.
Yeah, and it's a great show, but it's like, what if Atticus Finch was not this perfect hero from the movie, but was like, just pulls, like, they just pull a lot of punches so that he does the right thing, but he'll hesitate in ways that are so compelling, because you want him to just be the hero.
Yeah.
But there are times when he's not, and it's,
I think it sounds worth it.
Yeah, $75. It's a lot for an envelope full of burned discs.
With numbers on it.
Yeah, so
the outline of this episode, quickly, and then we'll get deeper into it, is like, the first scene is her leaving her apartment and a guy's had a heart attack.
Which is a running gag on the show.
Yeah, he gets in. And
she doesn't know who her neighbor across the way is, and he'll like leave the door open and she'll speak into it and he'll close the door. But then there was this runner where paramedics were always taking this old guy out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, so that's the first scene. And then the second scene is, quick scene, is her seeing Dr. Litchfield on the street.
Litchfield ignores her.
Ignores her. Third scene is her at her job.
Her job. She works at a bookstore.
Bookstore. And there's a Sybil Drayden, a Hollywood sex novelist, like romance novelist, is there doing a signing that no one planned for.
Yeah, David Strathairn plays the person who works at the bookstore. But he's so idiosyncratic and so absent-minded that he doesn't even seem to be aware of how the bookstore runs. Like, he never seems to know who opened it. Before she goes in to look for a job, and he hires her, but it's sort of like, how did this bookstore function prior to her being
there? Because this person is there, and everyone is like, they're like, well, everyone seems to love this, so we need more of these books. It's like, who is this person? How did she get there? That's a crazy enough plot for a whole episode, only gets that one scene.
Yeah.
Because it immediately moves on to a date with Detective Nathaniel Hawthorne, which is a continuing...
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. There was her friend's apartment was broken into, and he was the detective who showed up, and then he was flirting with Molly Dodd, and then you see them on this date that had been set up in the previous episode.
And it gets crashed by Victor Garber's character, Dennis, who then, like, does his thing, I now know, being high-class, brutish crude.
Yeah.
And then it goes immediately to Molly moving a chair into her apartment.
Yeah, with one of her sisters and her mother.
Okay. And then they just talk about, like, we should have had a man here to bring the chair in.
Yeah.
And there's a really weird joke about Molly's like, well, I'm...
Although, I will tell you, I have begun to feel some strange rumblings.
White Anglo-Saxon Protestant rumblings?
Let's just leave it at rumblings.
Oh, no.
Yeah. One of the things, I think I was talking to you before about how this show is progressive for its time, but then there are things that play weird to a modern audience. But one of the things I remember the time being very striking, that this was her character throughout the series will date men of various ethnicities, the only way that it's ever really commented on is through supporting characters who have a problem with it, but it's never an issue in terms of there being
super cool.
Like, her mom will say something and she'll just sort of dismiss it. Or,
right. Yeah.
In I think the next episode, Dennis Widmer, the next time we see Dennis Widmer, Victor Garber's character, he makes a comment about that black cop you're dating. Like, he makes a comment about it, but it's never, and every now and then there's something like there'd be a plot line where she's like dating, a Hasidic Jew. She goes on a blind date or something. No, it's not a blind date. She teaches a piano lesson and the guy shows up and he's a Hasidic Jew. And they play like this Jewish music as the sound cue. And it feels like, oh, now they wouldn't do that because it like corny and maybe even offensive.
Yeah, too much.
And it would be like if she's dating in an early episode, there's this guy who asks her out who I think is from like India or someplace. And the music cues are very on the nose. They're very like, now if you did that, it'd be like, hey, that's offensive.
Yeah.
But it'd be like, this show's doing it because the show is trying to normalize that she's a woman who belongs in New York. It's the melting pot aspect of New York City, and that she's a character that doesn't see any of these things as issues.
And that's definitely different from like Friends and Seinfeld, where it's an all white cast and they mostly only date white people.
Yeah.
Like almost exclusively. Friends.
Ross at one.
Ross
time.
Has Aisha Tyler.
Yeah.
Oh, and then Julie on Friends is Asian.
Yeah.
So, but that's about. Yeah, so that's cool to do that. The scene after that is she finally goes to Dr. Litchfield's office, and we get probably the longest scene in the episode, which I guess is why it warranted being the only thing in the description.
Right.
That I just found online at a site I don't know what it was.
Yeah.
I was just looking for any.
There's also like, this is not a show because it's never been released on home video. There's never been. These DVDs are literally people taping it off of Lifetime when it aired a lot because it was a Lifetime original series for 3 seasons. So they also would air the 2 original seasons and they would air them a lot because they were proud of it. This was sort of like a crown jewel.
Also not much to show at that time.
Yeah, Lifetime didn't have a lot. Like now we think of Lifetime original movie.
I watched Project Runway there every week.
Yes. But this was like quality television on a cable channel.
It was getting them Emmy nominations.
Unheard
of. Almost.
But these DVDs are literally like VHS recordings of those broadcasts because I think in the past 20 years, there may have been like some obscure cable channels high up the dial, in the hundreds on your cable channel.
Is Odyssey one? Epic?
Yeah, like MeTV. There's certain kinds of
antenna.
I don't know which show.
Yeah.
Which channel it would have been on, but there have been airings, but it's hard to find any real solid information about the show anywhere. It's not tremendously.
Even its IMDb doesn't have, its Wikipedia page doesn't have a list of episode titles.
No.
Which is insane because
everything does.
Everything else does.
Because all it takes is one person. Jay Tarsus could do it.
You could do it.
I could do
you
it.
You have all the episodes.
I know,
done.
I have it. It's exhausting. I can't do that.
The last scene, we get that scene, and then the last scene, she comes home, and the elevator is getting fixed.
They're transitioning from Davey, the elevator operator, for the first season, and for, I guess, the first 2 episodes of the second season. He is operating like an elevator that has a little gate and everything, and then the building changes over to a regular push-button self-service elevator, so he becomes just the doorman for the building.
For the rest of the series?
For the rest of the series.
Oh, good. I like him.
He and Molly Dodd are the only 2 characters who I think are in every episode of the show.
Right, yeah, I noticed that looking at IMDb is that it's very scattered. Like, no one else is in all. It's like 65 episodes? Yeah, because there's 13.
Yeah.
Which is another thing, like, five seasons. 65 episodes is, nowadays, definitely enough to get into syndication and run.
Yeah.
Because now we consider that a huge success.
Yeah, 65 episodes, more than five seasons of Game of Thrones. That's 6.5 seasons of Game of Thrones.
Yeah, that's crazy. So deeper into the episode, I want to talk about, well, the episode opens up, and you had to tell me that Molly's mom narrates the opening.
Yeah.
Her job in a bookstore. Reading. She's not supposed to be reading. She's supposed to be working for her new boss, shown here at Wright. Reading. There's something insidious about all this reading. For one thing, you do it by yourself. All alone, unaccompanied. And people need company.
Because again, like, I would not have known that.
No, and I realized as the scene was happening, I'm like, I should say something because it otherwise makes no sense. And you could easily think that it was Blair Brown's inner monologue, because it's the first time. She wasn't speaking, she was reading a book, and you hear this woman's voice.
Who's very anti-reading.
Yeah. the episodes, I don't know why, but it is something they stick with, I think, through the whole run of the series. It's always like, let me tell you about my daughter.
But
she's also not, the mom's not in every episode. It's not like a Gilmore Girls type show where the mother-daughter relationship is central.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
We get the opening credits, and I wrote that it's a very Lifetime-y opening, but this is NBC, so it's all, like, shot through a Barbara Walters, like, filter. It's
mostly still photographs, a lot of still photographs.
It's very specific late 80s, because there's, like, the late 80s, it's, like, Saved by the Bell, it's, like, fun and neon.
Yeah.
But then there's, like, the pastel greeting cards, precious momentsy side of the late 80s, in a way.
But also it's very New York.
It really is.
It's all just New York City images, like a sign of West 76th Street, and a shot of Central Park, and a shot of, you know, it's just like,
I wrote that the filter on it reminds me of a Korean karaoke music video.
Yeah, I don't know how much of that is how degraded the transfer is, that these are like third generation recordings.
It does seem like there's like a frame rate difference that makes it that kind of like dreamlike. But again, I actually don't know if that's
the beat. I mean, somewhere I like to think that there's someone in a lab that is preparing the Blu-ray.
Yeah.
It's just like going through and making sure it's
re-editing,
like,
every to give it the 16:9 aspect ratio treatment. The first scene was you explained that to me about how there's the guy dying, or he has a heart attack all the time. Because there was that joke of,
it's you two, isn't it? You live in there. You've got like some sort of weird dormitory for paramedics. You're holding this poor man hostage.
Which I thought was a great joke.
Yeah. it's very like, the most like overtly comedic aspects of the show often just have to do with that New York's crazy.
Yeah.
So like the idea of two paramedics just appearing in the hallway and taking over the elevator, and you have to get off the elevator now. And they're kind of in this weird little fight where it's like, what are you guys doing? Yeah. It's like, we can't tell you that, lady. And they get in the elevator, and it is like, oh yeah, New York's a crazy city.
Yeah.
And I feel like that is a, like when I started rewatching this recently in preparation for this, I was struck by like, oh, paramedics taking an old man out of the apartment, taking the elevator, is a very dark and funny joke for a New York City show. It's like,
That totally would happen, though.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, all the time.
Yeah, but even just, like, the fact that two episodes in a row you have the same thing. She's like, what is... Because she's also like, who is this guy? Who lives here?
And also the fact that it requires viewers in 1988 to have watched last week. Like, this is one of the first shows I've done. First of all, this is the first show I've done on this podcast, I think, that doesn't have a laugh track.
Mm-hmm.
And second, I think it's the first one I've done that is this heavily serialized.
Yeah.
Aside from the Fresh Prince running for judge whatever plotline, which we discovered was actually a plotline.
Yeah.
Then we go to the bookstore, which I wasn't sure if it was a library or a bookstore, but I guess since they were buying things, obviously it's a bookstore. My inclination was library at first.
Right.
She's a librarian. I could see her being a librarian.
Yes.
I could very easily see that. Is there romance between her and the guy? Okay.
That's one of the things that's also intriguing about this, is that there's this kind of, she goes on the date with Nathaniel Hawthorne, the cop, but it's right after the scene where Moss Goodman, the David Strathairn character. I never know if I'm saying David Strathairn's name right. I pronounce it differently every third time I say it. But he's one of my favorite actors. If you've never For those of you who don't know who David Strathairn is, I recommend the movie Limbo, which is a great John Sayles movie. He was like one of the actors who was in tons of John Sayles movies. Okay. And Limbo is one of my favorites, and he's like the lead actor in that. But this was the first thing I saw him in. I loved his performance in this. And there's definitely like this weird sexual tension and chemistry that's bubbling up. And I remember as a kid being like, almost like, it was shocking to me that it was like, oh, you have this one relationship that's sort of happening.
Yeah.
But then she goes on this date with this cop as well. I'm like, oh, like Molly Dodd is sort of like playing the field. She's sort of like, she's looking for a relationship, but it was tense and intriguing to me to watch a show in which she was kind of like being pursued and pursuing multiple people at the same time. Because that's not the normal. Normally, if that's the plotline on a sitcom, it's because there's trouble.
Yeah.
And there's a point later in the season where Nathaniel Hawthorne like comes over to her house, drops by her apartment, and she's sick, and he like makes her chicken soup, and he's like overtly like says he wants to be in a relationship with her, and she's like, "Well, I'm actually kind of seeing someone right at the moment," and he was like, "Oh, I didn't know that." And it's not a big deal. He doesn't storm out or anything.
Yeah.
But he's like, oh, that's too bad.
Yeah.
And you can see, watching the season, you're like, oh, if he'd asked her in this episode, she would have said yes to him.
Right.
Because she hadn't yet established anything. And it is just, it's an interesting dynamic because we're sort of trained by sitcoms that if we see a character who's like, dating like that, it's in the context of like, the first image that comes to my mind is like, Jack Tripper in Three's Company. It's like he's got 3 dates in three different apartments.
No.
He's like running up and down. It's like they're all gonna like humiliate him at the end of the episode. Yeah,
it's very progressive and open. Because even like you know Mary Tyler Moore, her whole thing was like single woman, independent woman, but she rarely dated.
Right.
But it's also like it was cool to see like well her job is important to her, and that's the series finale. So being like I never got married and had kids, but you guys are my family. Tears.
Yeah.
So it's cool to see the kind of like she has a job and then also is pursuing and is like out there and doing things.
She's also like Molly Dodd is portrayed as this smart and capable character, but is also like kind of a fuck up too. Like she's not successful.
Right.
She's not a successful person. She is a nice but not too nice an apartment. It's not an unrealistic New York City apartment. At least not in the grand scheme of TV New York City apartments. Hers looks like a real place.
Yeah.
But she is a character that is like kind of screwed up in a lot of ways, you know, and a lot of the things that are charming about her are also the things that are clearly sort of like I had an epiphany a few years ago, which was I was living in New York City. I was in my mid-30s, I was divorced, and I was working in a bookstore, and I had this epiphany that was like, oh my god, I've turned into Molly Dodd.
What happened?
that I was, I had overtly checked so many of the boxes, I was like, how did this happen? Like, how did I become, how did I absorb so much of this, relatively short run sitcom that I never would have imagined at a certain age. So I would be like, that's what I'm like. It wasn't a goal, but I had done it. Like, I can't think of another sitcom character that I ever had this many things in common with, you know?
Yeah.
I guess at some point there could be something about like a guy who does improv or something where I was like, oh, that's closer or whatever. but there wasn't the point where I was just like, oh, I work at Barnes & Noble Union Square and I am divorced and I'm living in New York City. I'm at the same age. And I'm just like, oh, okay. I'm trying to figure it out.
And no wonder it resonates.
Yeah.
Because it affected your life deeply.
Yes.
after the scene in the bookstore, we go to the date scene, which is where basically we get Victor Garber, which is why I was super excited.
Yes.
Because I first knew him from, well, I guess I saw Titanic, so I knew that. But
right.
Whatever, Titanic. Alias is where I, like, loved him. Fell in love with him, et cetera. Like, he's so great.
I mean, what's so amazing about him, and we could just do the podcast just about him, and I'm by no means a comprehensive expert, although
no.
I will say,
I'm not either.
That show I'll Fly Away that I'm thinking about getting on DVD-R, he is in one episode of that. And at the time I was like, the show can do no wrong. Yeah. I was just like,
I only know him from Alias and, like, Legends of Tomorrow, which, have you seen Legends of Tomorrow?
I have not seen Legends of Tomorrow.
Great, it's...
That's a currently running show?
Yeah, it's the DC comic show that he's in that is insane, and it's...
Let me ask you this, have you ever heard the soundtrack to the musical Assassins?
No, but I know of it because I've listened to Don't Get Me Started.
You need to. I mean, you absolutely must listen to the original soundtrack recording of Assassins. As a listening experience, it stands alone. You don't need to know anything. It works as an audio play.
Yeah, yeah.
And Victor Garber plays John Wilkes Booth.
Oh!
And his performance in The Ballad of Booth, which is basically this... you have a narrator who's a balladeer. It's my favorite play. Assassins is my favorite play. And it's a Stephen Sondheim's exploration of all the different people who at that time had successfully assassinated or tried to assassinate President of the United States. And The Ballad of Booth is Victor Garber very powerfully performing a song from the point of view of John Wilkes Booth. It includes a shocking crescendo to the song that is so, like, if it wasn't so well performed, it could be the most problematic thing, but because it's a great example of, like, an actor committing so hard and being so great in a role that it's like you get chills listening to it. This is, I believe, not the later, there's a second recording, but I believe on Spotify or something, you should be able to find the original recording of Assassins. He's great. He can do no wrong.
This is the first time that I think I'd seen him do really straight comedy.
Yeah.
He was on Difficult People this season and was great.
Yeah.
In that as a creepy child molester. And so this is the first, but like, he delivers a line where he like comes and he interrupts Molly's date with Nathaniel Hawthorne and then like, can I speak to you privately? And then he has this whole like, you need to stop coming at me, you're being crazy to her when he's in front of Nathaniel Hawthorne. But then when he pulls her away, it's like,
ignore her, she's nothing. A stopgap, a vent, a valve to let off steam. I'm Mount St. Helens, Molly. I totally lost my mind and it's your fault.
I'm madly in love with you. I can't get enough of you. He totally is a 180. And then he has this great line of like,
let's form a suicide pact. I can't. I gotta be in Great Neck tonight. It's my daughter's first communion. But I could be late. Or we could go together. Do you like communions?
Super great delivery.
It's every line is delivered with such skill that I remember when Alias started and I was so thrilled that like Victor Garber was on a great show.
Yeah.
And I was also like, oh, and even though there are moments where he's funny on that show, because there is comedy with Alias, but it's more often an intense show in which he is called upon to be
the scariest person on the show, whose reputation is that he's terrifying.
Yeah.
And usually the comedy comes from the juxtaposition of his terrifyingness with, like, having to, like, deal with a cell phone or something. Like,
a lot of good, like, deadpan humor from him in that. But how did it feel to see him doing something like this, where it is...
As someone that has a comedy pilot that is written for Victor Garber, this was good proof that I am on the right track. And hopefully that
because
will happen.
when I was watching this when it first aired, I was like, "That guy's hilarious."
Yeah,
and I had no idea who he was. So it really was like I
feel like there's so many things that our opinions of the thing are prefaced by knowledge of, like, people like this or people don't like this.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, when you watch something now, you usually have heard, like, oh, people are like this.
Rotten Tomatoes score. Yeah, yeah. That's what my friend's saying.
It's very hard to find stuff that you just go in blind. Mm-hmm. You normally have some inkling one way or the other that, whether you agree with it or not, you know, your reaction is always a little bit in relation
to... That's why I'm never going to watch a San Junipero episode of Black Mirror.
Because
everyone has been like, you have to watch it! It'll change your life! And like, you just set up way too many expectations for me. So, and no matter how I react to it, it's going to be weird and wrong.
So I sort of cherish whenever I've had reactions to things where I really didn't have any information except like, oh, this show is on right now, or this movie is... Like, I remember watching this and feeling... I didn't know anything about it. I was just like, what's this show? And it's not like any other TV show. And I'm like, that guy's hilarious. That guy's one of the funniest people I've ever seen on a TV show. And then everything that ever came later confirmed, I was like, oh yeah, he's great. Everyone knew he was great. And the reason he got this role is because he was a guy who obviously people were like, this guy's great. I remember having an opinion. One opinion I'm always really proud of is when the movie The Firm came out.
Yeah.
And I had never read the John Grisham book, but everybody and everybody's mom had all read The Firm. They'd all read that book. It was like the big, like, oh yeah, it's the big John Grisham.
It's the beach read that year or whatever.
Yeah. And when the movie came out, I loved that movie. And then everyone was like, oh, they ruined it. And the book was so much better. And I was like, really? And I was like, I better read that book and see how much better it was. And I read the book and I was like, oh, they're wrong. Like, this book is garbage, and they made a masterpiece out of it. And I was like, every change they made in the movie, and I stand by this, every change they made in the movie is an improvement on what was in the book. And I would get in these arguments with people, and I had them, and this was like in a sort of a pre-IMDb sort of era where you wouldn't just look up it.
Right.
And I was like, that movie's way better. I'm like, I don't know if this is the only book that those people ever read, so they just want to have that opinion because it's the usual. But I'm like, this is an example where the adaptation is better. And then when I eventually looked up who had done the adaptation, it was Robert Town, the screenwriter of Chinatown and many other great films. And, like, someone that is sort of, like, a go-to example, like, who's a great screenwriter? Robert Town. I was like, you know what? I knew it. Yeah. I knew this was
vindication.
So, like, my Victor Garber opinion was sort of, like, how I like, can trust that as, like, one of my barometers. I'm like, this guy's great. Oh. And then everything that I would ever see ever again in my life with him is like, yep.
Yeah. He is really funny on Legends of Tomorrow.
Oh, I gotta watch it.
I tell everyone, watch the episode that is set in, because they travel through space. It's basically like if It's Always Sunny was Quantum Leaping.
Oh, okay.
Because it's a crew of dumb assholes.
Is this on the
CW? The CW? It's part of the Flash Arrow universe.
Gotcha.
And it's all like the C-list, like, leftovers from those shows. All the Sprite characters became the main cast of this show. And he is one half of Firestorm, so he's like the professor half, and he is like a gestalt with a young kid who becomes Firestorm.
Great.
There's an episode where they travel back to the Civil War because a zombie outbreak has broken out in the Civil War, and so they're going there to fight Confederate zombies.
Yeah.
And they just give Dr. Martin Stein a phobia of zombies, and as soon as he gets there and he sees it at zombies, he immediately is like, don't say it, don't, I can't, oh, and it's just like Victor Garber doing like nebbishy like panic the entire time.
Yeah.
His plotline is great. He's stuck on the ship with a zombie and is just like, it's like Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote throughout the ship while the rest of them are out fighting zombies. And it also has one of the realest depictions of slavery I've ever seen on television. So it's a fucking crazy show.
When I worked at Barnes & Noble Union Square, Victor Garber was in the store once and asked where the bathroom was. And I told him where the bathroom was. I remember thinking, like, I played it just right. I was I was helpful in a human way and I didn't make him feel... I was like... Because I have this thing whenever I've interacted with famous people in this kind of context, I'm like, they just want a normal thing.
Yeah.
They don't want you to intrude or feel... And so I was just like, extra nice, but didn't like... I wish in hindsight maybe I'd said like, you're great on Days and Nights of My God, because it would have impressed.
Yeah.
But I could have also been freaky in a way that would have made him feel like I should never ask where the bathroom is.
Yeah.
But I remember thinking, like, I played it right. I gave him a normal human interaction, which is...
I did the opposite when I met Victor Garber.
Really?
Because last summer at San Diego Comic Con, my old job at Comic Book Resources, where I was a reporter and interviewer, writer, editor. And so my boss gave me the task of interviewing the Legends of Tomorrow cast on camera. Because he was like, I know you want this.
Right.
Victor Garber so much. And so I interviewed both of them on camera, and it was like two halves, like four of them and four of them, and he was in the second half. And when he was getting like mic'd up, when we wait for everyone to get mic'd up, I think I said like, oh, I like your suit, because he was wearing this awesome blue suit.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I like your suit. And he was like, oh, thank you. And he was like super, because that was my testing the waters.
Yeah.
Because I was like, okay,
how friendly.
He's nice. He's very friendly. And then the interview, he was like super nice. Katie Lotz, who plays White Canary on the show. Mm-hmm. Was like wearing a captain's hat, very like drinking wine, having a good time, and they were like super friendly. They were really, really ridiculous friendly cast.
Yeah.
And then after it's over, I was like, this is my chance. And so I had to just be like, go from, I just spent 10 minutes interviewing you like a professional.
Right.
Now I'm like, oh, excuse me, I'm gay and you're one of my gay heroes, and can I get a picture with you? It was like this, like, all of the, professional edifice had just crumbled away, and it was like this full blast of sincerity coming right at him out of nowhere, and he was immediately like, oh, okay, yes, and he like grabbed me, put his arm around me, and, like, I was trying to take a selfie. He was like, oh, no, the light's way better over here. So, like, we moved.
Oh, that's so nice.
My camera guy, like, took my phone, took the picture. And he was, like, super genuine and nice, and it was, like, really quick. And then it was done, and it was just like, that was... And then I had to be like, oh, I came out to Victor Garber, which is, like, a really weird thing to say. But it's also, like, that's what I have very few gay celebrity role models that are, like, my... Like, people that I actually, like, want to look up to.
Right.
And knowing that he is an actor that nailed, like, the role of Jack Bristow.
Yeah.
Which is a role that, like, is demanding and tough and mean and cold, which is not what you think of when you think of, like, gay actors.
Yeah.
I really loved and respected the breadth of his work.
Yeah.
And I think that's, like, a role model that I have.
It's also... There's also a thing with, you know, he's so good. In Molly Dodd, he's so good at playing a total creep. Just, like, a real selfish asshole. And there's a thing that sometimes happens where you'll see someone who's, like, really good at playing a creep or an asshole, and then you find out that in real life, the actor is like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And it really takes the shine off it in a way that it's kind of like, oh, so we're just watching...
Just, this is them. Them. That's not good.
being sort of glorifying their own worst aspects.
Didn't Victor Garber walk Jennifer Garner down the aisle? Or, like, he was at her wedding and maybe in the party. Like, they were still friends.
Yeah.
Like, it's great.
And it's just one of those things where it's like, the it would be harder to enjoy the performance, even with the skill level of it, as Dennis Widmer, if you thought this guy really was, like, this kind of slimy guy, you know?
Yeah. So he is great. It's really also cool to seeing him, like, 15 years younger than I'm used to seeing him. Like, a good 12 years younger or so.
Yeah.
Great. Although, like, from air to VHS to DVD-R copy.
Right. So, there's a blur around him.
Like, I get the gist, but... I wanted to talk about the... Speaking of coming out stories.
Yes.
The Dr. Litchfield scene. Which, I wrote down, like, this is my nightmare. Like, because Molly Dodd, like, I have the same thing with, like, I have a therapist, and when I go, it's like, when she just comes in and starts talking.
Right.
Nonstop, I'm like, yeah, that's 100% accurate. I'm like, I relate
that's
to
relatable.
That. But your fear inside is, I hope they, like me, or I hope I'm not annoying them, or I hope that... And so, like, when I thought the scene was going to be her breaking up with her and being like, I can't have you as a client anymore because you were actively ruining my profession.
Right.
Which is where I thought the thing was going. I was like, that's a nightmare scenario.
Yeah.
To have, like, all of your worst fears totally confirmed.
Yes.
And, like, thrown in your face. But then it goes in a different nightmare scenario.
Yeah.
Like, an even weirder, more fucked up bitch. Like.
Yeah. It's an incredibly complicated scene.
This
scene wasn't the reason that I picked this episode, but because I knew I wanted an episode for you that had, I wanted an episode that had David Strathairn in it. I knew that we had to pick an episode that Victor, it would be a criminal of me to pick an episode for this podcast that didn't include Victor Garber,
because
he's not in every episode. And then when I realized this scene was in it too, I'm like, oh, this is like a pretty... kind of a deep dive of a scene.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this is really complicated in terms of the way that it resolves as a scene is kind of this unresolved. It just is this sort of like awkward tension that dissipates and gets sadder it's not a scene. She basically confesses that as a therapist, she was talking to her therapist and she'd been away for a few weeks and had determined that she's in love with Molly Dodd.
Yeah.
And that she doesn't identify.
I don't usually fall in love with women. I don't think of myself as gay.
And Molly Dodd's reaction is also hard to read because she's uncomfortable with it.
Yeah. Even if, like, there's already a level of uncomfortableness when your therapist says that they're in love with you. And it's like... That's even
it's
if it was a man,
a boundary.
If it was opposite gender, like if it was, it would just be the creepiest.
Yeah, because there's an element that it feels like a violation.
Yeah,
in some ways, and so.
But it sounds like it's hard to find a therapist. It's like, well, great, now I have to go find someone else.
Yeah, and it also she also feels foolish that she's been sort of like chasing her down cheerfully and had this different demeanor.
That's gotta been torture for Litchfield.
Yeah,
I'm trying to ditch this person that I'm like inappropriately in love with, and they keep coming after me. They want me.
Yeah.
Ugh.
And then At the tail end of the scene, the phone rings, and it's a guy named Kenny,
yeah,
who's in town, and it's clearly like they're making a date for that night, and Molly Dodd just gets up and quietly leaves, and we hear the phone conversation. She's like, yeah, yeah, no, it'd be great. Yeah,
the therapist is heartbroken. Looks. Yeah. Like, it's, her face sinks, like...
Yeah, and it almost feels like you're leaving this character who is now maybe trapped in a life that she doesn't want. You know, it's just so sad.
Does she come back, or is that it?
I don't think that we see that character again.
Oh my god!
So it is like...
That's so sad!
So this is like, you watch The Cosby Show, you watch A Different World, you watch Cheers, and then you watch this... And it's not that those other shows wouldn't occasionally have
scenes
that are devastating or things like that, but
a gay scene.
And not every episode of Molly Dodd has something that's that devastating. Yeah. But I think it is up to level in terms of the complexity and the just the emotional torment of a scene like that.
Is that it is. I do wonder. Well, no, bisexual was a term because David Bowie famously said he was.
Yeah.
And Elton John did as well in the 70s. So yeah, that existed. So it is interesting that, like, as a therapist, you would assume that she probably knows a lot about, like,
yeah,
sexuality, gender, et cetera, et cetera. And it is weird that she didn't say, like, I'm bisexual or I might be bisexual. And so she says, like, I don't usually fall in love with women, which implies that she has before.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a lot. I want to know more about that.
Yeah.
That is very much an intense scene to just drop and then leave.
Yeah. And it's also interesting because, like, the title of the episode being, here's a few variations on a sexual theme.
Yeah.
And that certainly relates to the bookstore scene where he reads the D.H. Lawrence
poetry.
Suddenly she became small in his arms. Small and nesting. It was gone. The resistance was gone. And she began to melt in a marvelous peace.
And he's reading that aloud to contrast its power with this,
like...
Wait,
was he holding a book?
No, it's from memory.
Okay, that's what I thought. I was like, but yeah, then I'm like, the transfer is so fuzzy. I was like, yeah, maybe he was actually holding a book.
Well, he's a little bit on the spectrum, certainly, yeah, so he kind of will, like, avoid eye contact and look down and things, yeah, like that. But, in among the episodes, like, here's a few variations on the sexual theme, sounds like a more lighthearted topic for an episode. I think it's like a gut punch to realize that the final part of this episode is going to be this kind of sad, aching scene.
Yeah. Oof. Do you have any final thoughts on this before I move on to the trivia section?
No, I think we've sort of covered all the bases. There's nothing more to say after that scene.
Yeah,
there's like a lighthearted follow-up scene to that where it's just her coming back to her building. Kind of because
she shares Chinese food with the doorman,
Davey. And it is kind of like, we see that she's sort of, by this point, sort of like shaken off the melancholy of the previous scene is a little bit...
The most awkward.
Just like, you can almost like feel that sort of thing. It's like, she probably went for a long walk after that, yeah, ordered way too much Chinese food.
She says,
food.
Like, I got plenty to share.
She's got like a giant bag. So it is like her way of like, okay, I got to cope with this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have like this and this and this and this. And then it's over.
So... For the season, for season two, Molly Dodd was the 28th most watched show of that TV season.
Not bad.
With an average of 16.1 million viewers.
Which, I mean, it's a smash hit.
That's insane. They're like, the new Will and Grace came back, and they're like, it got 10 million viewers.
Yeah.
Huge.
This like, what gets 16 million viewers
Big
now?
Big Bang Theory.
I mean, so it's the Big Bang Theory of its day,
yeah,
but when every other show was twice as big
was
a hit.
Super Bowl. Every other show was Super Bowl. That's just crazy. The top five shows of that season were, number five was Growing Pains, four was Golden Girls, three Cheers, two A Different World, and one The Cosby Show.
Yeah.
So, I can see this is nothing like anything else
I mean,
on the air.
Of those shows you listed, what was the fifth one?
Growing Pains, Golden Girls, Cheers, Different World
Cosplay. Golden Girls is probably the one that has the most overlap to it in terms of the way that show would tonally...
Yeah, it would kind of go... It got to a phase where every episode was a very special episode, but every episode was also still hilarious.
Yeah.
It really walked a line.
Yeah, I mean, it has way more hard jokes...
Yeah.
Than Molly Dodd does. But you could imagine it wouldn't be the worst programming to air.
No. Oh, and also that's an NBC. Episodes. I could see a night that was like Golden Girls, Empty Nest.
Days and Nights of Molly Dodd.
Yes!
And what? That, on Saturday night on NBC, that would have been the thing that like senior citizens would be like, and now the really young show.
Yeah, like, ooh, like, we're getting like hip.
Mid to late 30s. Yeah. Oh, got like, that would have been... That
travel back in time, become the... Was this Warren Littlefield era or Brandon Tartikoff?
It was actually... I believe it was actually Tartikoff's idea. Like, Tartikoff said to Jay Tarsis, you should create a show about, like, a woman in New York in her 30s figuring it out. Something like that. And then Jay Tarsis was like, oh, okay. And then he was friends with Blair Brown. He went to her and was like, I want to do this show for you. And then they talked about it. And they basically, between the two of them... came up with the notion that let's do a show that isn't like any other sitcom that is shot like a drama, doesn't have a laugh track, but it'll still be funny. And you can sort of like, I mean, someone would have done it anyway. I always feel like it's one of those things that like...
Yeah, I mean, Cop Rock was a couple years away. They were pushing boundaries left and right in this era.
Cop Rock's a show that clearly, if no one had made Cop Rock, maybe no one would have made a Cop Rock. But if no one made Days and Nights of Molly Dodd, within a few years, like, people will say that thing about, like, well, what if Dylan or the Beatles hadn't happened? I'm like, somebody would have, some band would have been like, we're writing our own songs. Like, there's certain things that would have popped up. And I feel like Days and Nights of Molly Dodd was the one that just happened to be the one that triggered it. But it is the one. Like, it's in the, when you look at so many shows now, it's not hard to pinpoint which shows where you're like, I bet that creator of that show. Yeah.
I honestly, like, I wrote down on my notes, like, Netflix could do a reboot of this tonally, and it would just fit right in. Or honestly, like, just buy the rights and add this to the fucking, because the tone of it is so in line.
I think there may be weird music rights things or something that, there's an article from probably, like, 10 or 15 years ago that's, like, David B. and Cooley talking about how, why hasn't Days and Nights of Molly Dodd come out on DVD? And, you know, there was, sadly, a few years ago, in case, let's say, the rights holders to Days and Nights of Molly Dodd are listening to this podcast.
Please. Well, if they have a Google alert.
Yeah.
Then.
Let's say they're listening to this podcast. There was a YouTube channel a few years ago where someone had painstakingly uploaded every episode of this show to the YouTube channel, and it was up for probably at least 6 months, and... Then they yanked it.
Were they these copies?
No. I mean, they may have been. They may have been. They weren't great. They were awful.
I wonder if there's just, like, one default he was taking. Or
he might have been. He might have been. Yeah. But,
You could do it!
They, but all this work, all those uploads, 65 uploads broken into two halves. So it's a lot of uploading.
It's a lot, yeah.
And then, out of nowhere, YouTube yanks it for copyright, the copyright holder of this. So I'm like,
what are they searching
for? Copyright holder... Wherever you are, either release this show or let someone else put it on YouTube. Yeah, like, if you're not going to pull the trigger and make it available, this show shouldn't be rotting in some vault somewhere.
Right.
It shouldn't exist. And also, don't shut down sell.com. I'm furious if my big mouth ends up.
I would love it if this podcast had that kind of reach. I mean, that'd be good for me.
Bad for sell.com.
And bad for all the Molly Dodd fans out there that ain't gonna get it.
Yeah, so I just don't know. I just don't know if there's any way that it's... Because with each passing year, the selling points become less and less. Like, if this... When Fringe was out, you could maybe say, like, right, hey, Fringe fans, you like Nina Sharp? How would you like to see her in a sophisticated adult sitcom?
We are such a niche culture, though, that... Yeah. I do feel like you could, if you release, again, like, if you release all 65, one DVD set, $100... Like... It'd have to be, like, high price point to justify it. But, like, as a curiosity...
Yeah, like, Warner Archive or one of these, like, companies that Rhino? Does, like, yeah.
Because, like...
Shout Factory.
Shout Factory
is the big hope for this show.
Because the Bob Newhart show had, the first four came out on DVD back, you know, in the DVD TV craze of the 2000s. And then 5 and 6 languished, never came out. And then Shout Factory got the rights, released 5... And then, annoyingly, never released six on its own, but they released the whole series.
Yeah, you gotta take what you can get.
Bought the whole series, but
I mean,
still, they
did. The fact that Shout Factory released Mary Hartman, which is on my bucket list of things that it's like,
yeah,
it's hundreds of episodes and you've gotta, it's a lot of work, but I wanna see it. But they released that, so I feel like there's a chance that they could release this.
Wherever it is.
But it's also, another thing I will say about the show, as great as it is, and, you know, I know some people who are on Orange is the New Black, who've done, like, monologues at ASCAT and things like that. And each time someone from that is on, I'll always kind of bring up, like... and I work to try to get Blair Brown, like, to do ASCAT monologues or something at some point. It could happen. You know, it could happen. Get her to sign my bootleg DVD.
What are these again? Albums.
These are your show, you made.
This is what it is. Would that be depressing? Like, this is what it's come to. Like, this is...
No, I mean...
she'd be fine.
Was she ever
on the cover of TV Guide?
I have a framed ad... She wasn't on the cover of TV Guide, but I have a framed ad that my friend J.D. Amato gave me for my birthday one year that was... it's for one of the seasons of Days of My Dad. It's like a full-page black and white newsprint ad. I did a day on Orange is the New Black for the season that's coming out next year, which the day after I got cast in it, it hit me that I'm like, oh, I am now on a TV show. Yeah. I am 0 degrees connection to Blair Brown. There is an aspect of this show that I wonder if, like, if it was streaming, if it was, if someone picked up, if Hulu or Amazon or anybody, like, have the rights to it.
Or CBS All Access.
It is one of those shows that I wonder about for a new audience coming to it. So many of the things that are great about it are actually things that have already been absorbed into other shows to the point where they're no longer innovations.
Right.
That it may seem like a fairly sedate show or a fairly, like... you know, because even a show that's as, like, groundbreaking as Twin Peaks, people who watch at least the original seasons of Twin Peaks, when they see them now, they might think, like...
I've already seen X-Files.
I've already seen a dozen shows that have borrowed from this.
Yeah.
Molly Dodd, which was already a subtle show to begin with, so many of the innovations had been absorbed into things like Adam and Beale or Sex and the City, which maybe did it with more overt kind of like razzle-dazzle.
I will say, like, if for the entire, you know, TV hive mind people that, like, really, like thinking about this stuff, like myself,
yeah.
It was super fascinating to see something that looks like 1988, but also doesn't look like 1988.
Yeah.
Like, that is the, like, look and feel of a Cheers at that era, but also not at all like it. Like, it's a, as a curiosity of people that, like, love the history of television.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah.
Worth watching and worth tracking down at sell.com.
And a great New York show in terms of, like, it, you know, there's so many shows I love that are New York shows, particularly of the New York shows that are filmed in L.A., you know, that, like, Friends or Seinfeld or things like that, like, they don't really capture what it feels like to live in New York. They are their own alternate universe. They might as well be on the moon in many respects. They create their own internal logic and reality of how things work. This is a show that, even though New York is different, very different now than it was then, it captures a lot of things that are still hold true about New York in terms of the...
I think you could do this episode today. Like, nothing really dated it that much.
But it's like the places that people go to eat, the places that people grocery shop, it all kind of feels like, even though, like, I only lived in Manhattan for a few years of my overall time in New York, but when I did, I was like, when I was walking around, I was like, this is very Molly Dodd. Like, I would have that feeling of, like, this feels like I'm living in the same city.
Yeah.
I did, a few years ago, it was too much work to do it. A few years ago, just for fun, I was going to try to find the locations that are in the opening credits and just film a version of the opening credits with me
of course.
In those spots. It was too much work.
Who would you say had the must-see performance in this episode?
I mean, it's Blair Brown. Just because that's true of every episode of the show. Comedically, Victor Garber, because he's the funniest one in the episode. Yeah. But... it truly is a show that, like, it lives or dies based on her. Totally, she anchors everything in it. I don't know if there are rarely scenes that she is not in. There might every now and then be a scene between her mom and her sister or something like that, but for the most part, she's
heavy lifting.
Yeah.
I mean, I will give it to Victor Garber since you gave it to Claire Brown. For the reason you said, of like, he is actually the funniest one. And I think for me, coming and seeing him do like this kind of like straight great comedy, do it so well, is like great. Love it. I always ask, must other people watch this episode? And hopefully,
yes, you must. I realize it's a big requirement. I'm curious now if I look on, if I go to Cell.com and I look up Days and Nights of Molly Dodd, if it is even an option.
Oh, God.
The sad thing about recommending this show is to people is then people will be like, can I borrow your disc? I'm like, I don't wanna.
It's a risk. I mean, it's a risky thing.
Oh, boy. I mean, not a lot of.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm not seeing it here. Like, oh, it may not even... I may have oversold what can... No, let me look and see. Well, oh, God. I mean, like...
Scour the internet for it.
No, it is available.
Okay, good.
It is available, but literally you go to this... There's a seller named Siblis, and it's literally a listing of these are all the TV shows
that
he has available. And to give you an idea of it, like the first one that jumped out at me was like Amos and Andy, which is the notoriously famous racist TV show right above the Andy Griffith show. But like there are...
Were they in alphabetical order?
Yeah, what's this?
Bob Crane show?
Yeah.
Wait, what?
Bob Crane show is listed between Bionic Woman and Bob Hope Chrysler Theater.
How much?
You'll have to inquire.
Okay, I'm inquiring.
I mean, these are all listed as $75.
As soon as I get... I would do it, obviously. I don't know.
I mean, if you look up... it's a Year in the Life miniseries and 22 episodes, but then it's like... below is a list of other shows I have. So that $75 might just be... Bob Crane show might be more, might be significantly less.
Yeah, it's like only like 13 episodes. Well, here's that's some...
Here's the thing. It could be that it's like, well, Bob Crane show is not going to, it's no one wants this show. But if someone emails and says, I look for the Bob Crane show, I'd be like, you're the only, this is the only time.
You blow the dust off this.
Yeah, that it's kind of like, well, how much do you want the Bob Crane show? Because if you want it, you must want it a lot because no one wants it. You know,
okay, so my email need to be like, kind of like passing, like, hey man.
You might need to nag him a little and be like, yeah, so I saw you had this Bob Crane show.
I watched your Molly Dodd transfer. It was about? Like, okay.
Yeah.
Like,
I don't know if this is the guy that I bought my dad from, I mean, it's...
Yeah.
Do you have a second thing that has been hard to find like, on a wish list of shows? I'm just curious.
No, well, there's also the Paul Lynde Christmas special.
The Paul Lynde show is listed here.
Ooh.
Doesn't say Christmas special, but...
No, but he had a sitcom where he played a dad.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, so, listen...
Well, I've introduced you to a benign... underbelly of the internet.
Yeah, wait, suck my money.
This is a website that I've never had a problem with, and it looks like the kind of website that I would like the first time I ever ordered
malware left and right.
Yeah, I thought this is surely not real, and I did it, and it worked. But maybe the hope is that they hook a bigger fish, and I was just
and that is my listeners.
Yeah, so you have to you listeners you must listen to it. It was before they called it must-see TV, but it was certainly of the era in which the concept of must-see TV...
Oh, yeah, they were dominating on Thursday nights at that point. I mean, the top three shows of the year were from that, and then Molly Dodd was 28th.
Yeah.
So...
I mean, you could see why they canceled in that sense, because they were just like...
We don't need this.
We can put...
Oh, because it was also a placeholder for Night Court. Because, like, when Night Court would go away, this would come on.
Yeah.
So,
and Summertime was this was back when the idea of a summer series was like, summer was for reruns.
Yeah.
And people just wouldn't watch TV because, like, it was probably sandwiched in between rerun of Cosby Show, rerun of Different World, rerun of Cheers,
yeah,
new episode of Days and That's My Dad, rerun of L.A. Law.
That's a
bummer. So to a certain extent, 28th is not bad.
No.
You know? That,
I was
like,
I mean, it's top 30, which some of the shows I talk about aren't top 30.
16 million people.
Yeah, that's insane.
Yeah.
So where can people find you on the internet if they want? Or plug away.
Connor Ratliff. Everything. Connor Ratliff, ConnorRatliff on Twitter. If you're in New York City and you want to see me perform, most weekends, you can find me in shows at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater. And currently on, I'll pop up every now and then on the President Show on Comedy Central, and most weeks on the Chris Gethard Show on True TV. And next year, if I don't get cut from it, in at least one episode of Orange is the New Black, hopefully.
And yeah, follow on Twitter in case you get updates about Blair Brown doing monologues at Ask It.
Yes. You won't find out until after it happens because they never announced the monologues.
Oh yeah, that is true.
I won't find out about it until it's the week of, if it ever happens.
So yeah.
And I'll let you know if I ever get the U.S. Postal Service mailer that I have these things in. I think that's what I've decided I'm getting signed. No, I'll probably get my framed picture signed. That's nicer. Yeah. But I'll definitely show her those DVD-Rs if I ever meet her.
Thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
Yes. And that does it for this week's episode of Must Have Seen TV. Thanks again to my guest, Connor Ratliff, for dropping by and taking me on a journey of the wild world of the days and nights of Molly Dodd. Next week, we will begin our Christmas holiday gauntlet. So get ready for that. I'll be discussing the Dick Van Dyke Show episode, The Alan Brady Show Presents. That episode of The Dick Van Dyke Show, The Alan Brady Show Presents, a lot of show in that title. It's in season 3, it is episode 13 of The Dick Van Dyke Show. You can stream The Dick Van Dyke Show on Hulu or Amazon, and you can also purchase that episode. And you know what? Go on and make it a holiday treat for yourself. Purchase it on iTunes. Why not? Until then, you can send your questions about sitcoms to musthaveseentv@gmail.com. You can follow the podcast on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at musthaveseentv. If you like what you've heard, please rate and review the show in iTunes. I beg of you. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Brett White. You can read the words that I write at decider.com. You can check out my sitcom t-shirts and stickers at tpublic.com/user/Brett White. The theme song is Patricia's Moving Picture by The Go Team. Thanks to Acast for hosting the show. Thanks to everyone for listening, and I will see y'all next week on Must Have Seen TV.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.